Kia ora, welcome to The Point of Learning, a place for teachers and leaders to talk about what they're doing and join a wider conversation on teaching and learning. I'm your host Pete Hall, and this week we meet Margaret Thorsborne, leader in restorative practice and workplace conflict resolution. Margaret's work has transformed how many schools approach what we often call discipline or behaviour management. As a teacher or parent, if you've ever caught yourself nagging or raising your voice about the same old things, then restorative practice can really help. Today, Margaret talks about how her work began and why we need to look at things differently if we really want to help young people build good relationships. Here she is. Welcome, Mark. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Pete. It's a lovely opportunity.
I wonder if you could just speak a little bit to what brought you into restorative practice and what you've been up to the last few years.
My early experience in restorative practice was actually around how schools could handle bullying effectively. Because what we knew was that if you punish bullies because victims have complained about them, that you actually increase the risk to victims. And I just want to say straight up too that words like, labels like victims and wrongdoers and bullies are not terribly helpful. It's more about that person who did the thing and the person who had that thing done to them. So it was the interest, and certainly at that stage I was working for the Education Department in Queensland in Australia, and they had tasked a couple of us to work out a whole school approach to bullying. So we could handle the minor stuff pretty adequately, and we could kind of handle the medium stuff reasonably without having to resort to punishment. But how on earth did we handle the serious incidents of bullying where people were frantic, frightened of coming to school, heads had to roll? How do you do that in a safe way? And if you're a deputy principal or a principal, how do you bring people together without a fire hose in the office, really? Mm. So around that time, this was sort of 94, I suppose, so that's giving my age away a little bit. But we became very interested in what the police in our neighbouring state of New South Wales were doing, because they had been very interested in what New Zealand was doing with youth justice, involving family group conferencing. So bringing not just offenders face-to-face with their victims, but to engage with whānau as well. So that was a really interesting principle for us, and we actually thought we'd died and gone to heaven when we discovered what we now call a restorative hui, a restorative conference that brought people face-to-face and not talked so much about what rules have been broken, but really about what harm's been done and what can we do to fix it. So that story led us to cut a long story short, a trial of using a restorative process for matters that were very serious in schools that would result in kids being, in New Zealand terms, stood down or suspended or have a trip to the board. But in Australia, of course, the word is suspension, and in the UK they use fixed-term exclusion. So you're banned for, 5 or 10 days or something. So while that might be important to manage a crisis, what it can't do is of itself and by itself do any kind of repair work that's necessary, to people who've been harmed, including families. So even if you're the family of the kid who's responsible for the harm, there's damage done to the relationships at home. And certainly if you're the family of the child who's been harmed, that harm, you harm my child, you harm me as well. So those kinds of principles really alerted us to the fact that this was incredibly useful. And not long after my first attempt, which was applied to a case of a serious assault after a school social one night, and I applied these principles with a little coaching. I really didn't know what I was doing, but it seemed to work. I was asked by the head of our parent body, had this one event changed the culture in the school? And I had to say no. Because actually we only dealt with 4 kids, 4 families, a couple of staff members, and the whole school had 1,600 students in it. So the capacity to change the way we do business and our relationships with others can't be relied on just by dealing with serious stuff. So what's grown in the intervening years is the experimentation that's allowed educators to say, hold on, this stuff is too good just to use for serious matters. Why don't we apply it to any incident of harm, no matter how minor, serious? And so in the intervening years, we've had this extraordinary experimentation that has allowed people the space and the wisdom now to apply the same principles of accountability and responsibility to minor things. We've got specialists who've now been able to modify the process for very, very young children in new entrants' early years. We've found practitioners who've been able to modify the process so that kids with special needs are able to, you know, avail themselves of the opportunity and learning that this presents. So we now have what we call a continuum of restorative practice that can deal with the most serious things that happen right through to minor infractions. But the underlying message that we learnt from all of this is that you actually need to have something to restore to. That kids will not care about the impact of their behaviour on other kids if they have not learnt to care about them. And neither will they care about the relationship with the teacher unless there has been work done to develop a relationship of mutual trust and respect.
That's an extraordinary flip on how we've always traditionally done behaviour in schools.
It is indeed. So, you know, I'm so privileged actually to be living on the cusp of that social change where I was raised in a very authoritarian, although loving family, that if we did something wrong, we could expect the strap. So, you know, I learnt to duck and weave and I was a very good girl, but it was always about someone else managing me, external locus of control, really. And it took me a long time to take responsibility for myself without, you know, having someone breathing down my neck. So it was either a nun at a boarding school or my parents breathing down my neck or, you know, someone in charge of me until I think I was quite a late developer, but I've learnt to take responsibility for me now. And it's also this sort of different approach really has redefined the nature of the relationship between teacher and student. So back in the 50s or 60s or 70s, really, in our lifetime anyway, the relationship with the teacher worked provided obedience happened and that you and I'll get along okay provided you do what I tell you to do. And I don't want you to question anything. I don't want you to argue with me. I want you to sit down and shut up and suck it up. And if you do something wrong, you know what's going to happen to you and you're not going to like it, and that will deter you from doing it again. So that worked when everyone understood what the game plan was, I think. And so it's not really about whether something was the right way or the wrong way to do anything. That was a function of when we lived in our particular time. But things have moved now and we have different approaches. And in a modern learning environment, which is the catchphrase these days, of course, the teacher-student relationship is understood quite differently.
I think it's extraordinary how massive that changes from people who, you know, if you've got a poppet in your class who needs discipline, and I'm thinking of back in the day with the traditional approach, and what you would do is remove privileges and remove relationship and hold them accountable for damaging relationship and hold them accountable for losing privilege, potentially set them up for social shame and removal from a group and all of those things, and continue to hold them accountable for what you were doing to try and manage their behaviour. When in fact, what you were doing was pushing them down a path without any way of coming back, where it's harder and harder and harder to come back, because if you've got pride involved, anyone with a sense of pride who doesn't respect what's being done to them must rebel, you know.
Well, you have to, don't you?
You have to.
Really?
Rude not to.
It's part of the patch. But, You know, you're alluding to something that is a very serious issue at the moment in education, and it's a serious issue all over the world, so it's not just a New Zealand issue or an Australian issue, but it's something called the school-to-prison pipeline. And what we're increasingly understanding is that schools can play a huge role in crime prevention in the way they deal with the matters that are serious. But when we're talking about the low-level stuff, there's two ways to think about accountability, really. And the first way is the sort of traditional thinking that I will hold you accountable for what you've done because you've broken a rule and now you deserve to be punished. So that will tell you what you've done wrong and will signal the wrongness of it, but it won't tell you much else. So it won't reshape your skills. So, you know, if I'm thinking about my driving skills, and I always talk about this, where I live, north of Brisbane on the Sunshine Coast, I know there are three fixed cameras. And I know if I'm paying attention to make sure I'm within the speed limit when I pass those cameras. But the minute I've passed and the danger's gone, I will put my foot on the floor. So I will speed up even though I know that's a wrong thing. So that's really wrong thinking because my speed can contribute to all sorts of ghastly outcomes. But if we concentrate on something, well, the word discipline doesn't work much anymore for anyone, but the favourite at the moment is behaviour management. But it's still about a command and control approach. And I think we need to be thinking about behaviour development. And that, increasingly thinking that, as we understand more and more and more about how brains in children and adolescents develop. So that the common understood knowledge about brain development is that girls' brains mature by the time they're about their mid-20s and boys a little later. So I'm not sure what that's all about, but it seems to be the case. And listening to people like Nathan Macquarie-Wallace, you know, who's very cluey, really, about the neuroscience of child development, he says, really, that it's the prefrontal cortex in a child, particularly during adolescence, that is kind of under huge development. So, really, it's a mess. But while it's a mess, it's also very plastic, which means that we can, in a consistent way, a gently relentless kind of relational way, actually teach young people how to think. And little kids think they are the centre of the universe, and our job all the way through school is to teach kids they're not the centre of the universe, they are merely part of the universe. And so with the principles of restorative justice, you know, underpinning the way we do behaviour in schools, really, if we remember the three things, that one, that misconduct or inappropriate behaviour is a violation of people and relationships, and learning, of course. It's a violation of my learning and everyone else's learning if I'm mucking up, but it's the harm that's done. And I think we need to think injury rather than misdemeanour. What's the harm that's being done here? And if harm's been done, and we're the adults in the situation, and our prefrontal cortexes are actually mature, ours might be the only prefrontal cortex in the room that's actually mature, and so we have to help the kids learn how to self-regulate. But it means we have to regulate ourselves. We have to manage ourselves. We have to be mindful. We have to understand ourselves. We have to understand why we might be feeling really frustrated and horrified and disappointed by something a kid's done. But we need to keep ourselves under control if we're going to manage that situation through to an effective outcome. So where am I going with this? I think it's understanding that our best friend in understanding, knowing what to do, is really the new knowledge about plastic brains. So the people I get excited about these days are the writers who write about neuroplasticity, and one particular bloke who's really taken up my interest most recently has written two books, some of which you may know. One is called The Brain That Changes Itself, and his newest one is The Brain's Way of Healing. He's a Canadian doctor and a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst, and his name is Norman Doidge. And I can't think of a more important book for teachers to read about brains than this book. And, you know, if a kid is all over the shop, I'm starting to understand that those neural pathways in that child's brain have not yet been created, that they might have a very noisy brain, which means the neurons in particular patches might be misfiring and need to be regulated back to normal behaviour, in neuron behaviour, I mean. And another interesting piece that has come out of something that I've read of his lately is too that kids on the spectrum and who might qualify as autistic may well have inflammation of their neurons in their brains. And so I ask the question then, how on earth can punishment change any of that?
When has it ever?
Well, as I joke about the reduction in reoffending, the only guarantee you ever have to reduce reoffending in a particular child is to kill them, and we're not allowed.
Well, I think of that flip around from almost escalating our response to escalating behaviours, and if you were thinking 20 or 30 years ago where it was entirely acceptable to smack a child, and for an older child, you'd smack them harder, and at the nth degree, you kill a human being.
Hmm.
This is exactly the same scale for increasing damage.
Absolutely.
The idea that you might have a way of restoring problems that are particularly difficult when things are really hard, and then scaling that back to problems that are even more slight, that are more and more slight, all with a view to building relationship and building capacity, as opposed to that bizarre escalation of response.
Yeah.
All with that blame too.
Yeah. So what you're talking about, Pete, really is social evolution. Yeah. And there's another really good author that is important for an educator to read, and I think it's called Parenting for a Peaceful World by a Sydney psychologist called Robin Grille, Grille. And he actually traces the history of childhood over time. And when I read it, I was utterly and completely horrified with the way we used to treat children, but I'm talking pre-4th century. So there was no such knowledge about attachment theory, about nurturing, about any of that stuff. And so I think with the research that he did, and the book is filled with research, so it's not someone just writing about stuff they think happened. But my understanding from what I read in his book was that something like 20 to 25% of children never survived beyond childhood because their parents actually did away with them. Now, that changed over time. So somewhere between the 4th and 14th century, clearly killing your children wasn't acceptable anymore. But if you didn't kill them, you could still abandon them. So kids were left on the side of the road, handed over to monasteries.
And I imagine blamed for the reasons that they were left too.
Well, who would know the reasons? But it still wasn't regarded as wrong not to nurture your children through to independence. So things have changed enormously. And we're now at a stage where, you know, we need to educate ourselves about what's going to help really mature the prefrontal cortex in our children, whether they're our children of our own in our own families or whether they're children in other children in classrooms that we teach. But our job is to help mature the brain so that those kids aren't traumatised any more than they need to be, and that they can learn to self-regulate and calm themselves down and not be at the mercy of their emotional selves.
There are adults who are at the mercy of their emotional selves.
Yes, indeed there are. And if you're highly emotionally labile in a classroom as a teacher, that is, you're all over the shop and you're up one minute and down the next and kids can't read you, I mean, they're flat out reading the expression on someone's face when they're a young person. You know, they can't do that with any accuracy.
So now map that back to the modern learning environment that you were mentioning earlier.
Yeah.
And you have young people in an environment where they may have the experience of having trouble reading a teacher because the teacher may be one of two or three people in the space.
Exactly. So there are huge challenges, and we can mitigate the risk of that confusion by co-constructing with the little people or the adolescents and the teachers in the room, co-constructing what we want our classroom to look like, sound like, feel like, and be very, very, very clear about expectations. One of the things, of course, that the Ministry of Education in New Zealand is incredibly supportive of is positive behaviour for learning. It's a program for school improvement. And one of the rules around that, one of the guiding rules around PB4L is don't expect to see a behaviour that you haven't taught. So even if you're clear about the expectations in your own head, you've got to literally show a child what that means. And also understand perhaps the value of respect. That's a big one in schools. Everyone needs to respect each other, ourselves, our property, our environment, etc. But what does it mean? So you can have the most wonderful values plastered all over the front of the school foyer and up in school classrooms, but a value is of no value unless there is evidence of that value in people's behaviour. So we teach what we want to see. So the classic and a really low-level thing is good manners. So many kids, when I was raised, you know, the good table manners, for example, and standing up on a bus to let someone sit down and opening a door for someone and saying please and thank you, those basic sorts of things just were hammered into us like the times table. So we've got the neural pathways in our brains. But I'm not sure that the modern family in one part of a street would have the same set of manners as the family in the house next door. So if you're moving into that family as a visitor, as a child, then you're going to get, you know, taught fairly rapidly about what manners we do in this house. So when you extrapolate that to a classroom and your definition of respect is you're quiet while I'm speaking and you're all watching me, then you're going to have to teach it because you can't imagine that a kid's going to see inside your brain.
Now I'm thinking of how a young person might experience two different house rules. They would experience that so much more keenly than an adult. Because when adults go into adult spaces, there's a moderation, there's a set of allowances happening there because the power dynamic is pretty much equal, although you're more likely to work around what's happening in-house. Mm. So I imagine in a modern learning environment, it's the young people who have the best take on the differences between their teachers and can probably mirror that back more effectively than teachers might even be able to do so with each other.
Mm. But it's still, we call that code switching.
Yeah.
You need to be able to read the play, and that requires some sensitivity and alertness. So if you don't read the play because the unspoken and unwritten rules haven't been made explicit, then you will annoy people, you'll insult them, you'll offend them, you'll give people the wrong impression about the sort of person you really are. So, you know, if we want to see the behaviour, we have to teach it. And, you know, I had no idea, honestly, back with my first immersion in restorative practice, how this field has developed. It's just extraordinary to me to see how the ducks are lining up now. You know, the modern learning environment, social evolution, our understanding of brains and neuroplasticity, our better understanding of kids with special needs and the fact that they're not, you know, they're not evil personified. They actually have, you know, some difficulty somewhere along the line. Yeah. So, you know, we just got to, I think, in some ways I think that the role of the teacher has become more complex because we're expected to know more about what works and what doesn't work. And people outside education think that we just do it because we like the holidays. And sure, we like the holidays because we're exhausted, you know, by the end of 11 weeks or something. And you just kind of run out of oomph. And I think one of the biggest challenges for teachers, if they have their own children in their own family young, is that you use up so much of your emotional energy at school in a classroom that when you get home at night, there's not a lot left over, really, which is a bit sad.
My experience of working with teachers who were making restorative practice work in their classrooms, they talked about how long it took to run the process.
Yep.
And it was interesting to see the people who recognised that the short processes don't work, even though they're short. And that a long process, that longer process, is the process that works, and there is no short equivalent.
No, there is no, you know, it's the quick fix is a total myth. When you think about what the job is that you're trying to achieve, when you're trying to work with a kid to bring them along to your standards and your expectations, whether it's to do with learning or to do with manners or to do with social graces or just social skills in general, you're actually working with the neuroplasticity in their brain, and once off of anything is never going to be sufficient to build a new skill. So, you know, kids come to school and young people come to high school not knowing the game plan in high school unless they've had older siblings who've been through the same school. But even then, it's only hearsay. So I would think that it's reasonable to take a whole term to shape a kid to read the play about, you know, what the go is in a school. And when you've got, in a high school, five or six different teachers that you've got to kind of figure out what their game plan is, it's a very advanced skill.
And so much harder to do it in a setting where you don't have the time to build relationships with students the way you do in a primary classroom, where you'll have them from woe to go.
Yes, and the challenge, of course, is, and I always joke about this, that high school teachers have to be speed daters. That you have to very, very quickly get to know as much about that child as you possibly can, about their whānau, about their interests, about their hot spots and their sore spots and what they're interested in and what their, you know, what motivates them, everything. And I just wish that schools would down tools at the beginning of the school year and just abandon curriculum for a couple of weeks until that investment is made in getting to know each other, building trust, building mutual respect. And it's not just between the teacher and the kids you teach, but it's ensuring that the relationships between the kids in the classroom are safe and that everyone feels like they matter, that they belong. And then when something goes wrong, if that work has already been done, we can refer back to, you know, the values we decided on, the code of practice we decided on in our classroom. Here are the values we decided that were important. So help me understand how what you're doing now is really kind of helping with our relationships and building trust and mutual respect. Instead of saying, you're just naughty and get out of my sight. It's just not good enough. We don't. If you want to truly make a difference, it's the long haul that's going to do it, not
You've got to put money in the bank.
Yes, absolutely.
And you're saying, refer to it as harm that's been done, or harm that's been done. And I think you all, as a teacher, you need to participate in building something such that that harm wants to be repaired. That you've got young people who want to repair the damage they've done to a relationship that that you helped build, that's of value to them.
I always talk about these principles of restorative justice, that, you know, when something goes wrong, harm's done, and that we need to do something about the harm, and the way forward is to try and heal those harms and make things right. But when I think about our own two kids who are now sort of mid and late 20s, the kind of mantra that I use at home, and I hope it has stuck, and that's the translation of these restorative principles into home speak, really. I want my boys to understand that there's nothing in this life that we do or the or that we don't do that doesn't have an impact on someone else. And if you do muck it up, make a mistake, you know, hurt someone, insult someone, offend someone, frighten someone, that you've actually got to clear up after yourself. So if you make a mess, clean it up. If you break something, replace it or mend it. If you, to the extent that it is possible, if you hurt someone, you make amends somehow, so that you don't go through life leaving a trail of destruction, you know, that you're a person who, for whom your relationship with other people matters. Now, I don't mean you have to care about every human being in the world, but you have to care about the people who you connect with. So if you've got a class of 25 kids and you're one of those kids, I want you to care about the other 24, and I want you to care about me.
I know how some people hear the idea of restorative practice when they first hear about it, and they think, it's a bit touchy-feely, you know, just get some good hard boundaries in and that'll do. But I can say that from doing the 3-day intensive course, and part of that involves role playing, just going through the process of pretending to care about people was harrowing.
It was probably
one of the most powerful role play situations I've ever been in. And everyone had the same experience. And my first experience was as the wrongdoer, for want of a better word. And we all changed roles. And it actually didn't matter which role you were in. It was a tremendously demanding process that actually demanded so much more of everyone involved than the simple punishment model.
Yeah, I know. And so there is an enormous misunderstanding about what the restorative approach to problem solving is all about. And some parents and some teachers and some kids think, oh, I've just got to say I'm sorry and we'll have a cup of tea and it's all over. And it's, as you said, it's so much more than that, and so deeply, deeply powerful. So the whole idea of accountability is I have actually got to face the person I've done it to. I've got to take responsibility for the pain that I've caused them and the harm that I've caused others, because the ripples spread. So it's not just this other child I've harmed, but it's that other child's parents who are frantic. It's about my own parents who are worried about me and also deeply ashamed of what I've done. And what about that teacher who I really like, who now thinks that I'm a total idiot, you know? So I often ask a teacher if I'm having to be the neutral facilitator. So in the wake of what Peter's done, how has this changed the way you think about him? And the answer that I'm looking for always is, I'm not sure if I can trust him anymore. Now, if the child really cares about you as the teacher, that will be like a dagger in their heart. And, you know, that's where the leverage comes.
And I've seen that work. So one of the things that just never ceased to surprise me when I made this work in a variety of different settings with similar students who I'd come to know over a period of years and thought, right, I know how this conversation's going to go. And I think I worked out most of all that if I knew how the conversation was going to go, then I could hold myself entirely responsible for that, because I was the person in charge of where the conversation was going. And it was always boring. And I thought, I'm in charge of boring conversations that all sound the same to me.
Mm.
Actually handing it over and talking about trust, and I saw a group of young people, and one of whom was really motivated to try and lie their way out of trouble with a capital T.
Mm.
And as soon as you remove the idea of being in or out of trouble, and to reframe it to say, I'm not sure if your friends will trust you, but if you actually work towards repairing it, then they will. And I want to make sure that you have that chance. And I don't want you to leave this room without thinking about rebuilding that with your friends.
Mm.
And they did. And that was the only way it was ever going to happen. And I had a year and a half's memory of all the conversations where it all just went straight into the ditch and there was no getting around it. That was extraordinary. And the feedback I got back from those people was that they loved me helping them.
Yes.
And they got to know me as a teacher, which was extraordinary for me when I was actually, you know, the acting principal and had been all that year. And that's the time when you would usually be, it's usually harder to make that connection with young people.
Yeah.
And through that process, it was better than it had ever been.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment, Pete, because the conversations I've had with police who take a restorative approach to problem solving, working with young people out in the streets or adults in the streets when they're getting up to no good and they're trying to head them off at the pass, is that if the police officer understands the restorative principles and the dialogue that goes with that kind of problem solving, then it actually changes the attitude of that young person towards that police officer, because they see them as having a heart rather than just there about the rules. And I just watched a lovely TED talk just recently about a police officer in Brisbane who, before he became a police officer, spent a period of time on the streets as a homeless person himself. So he managed to turn his life around and then became dedicated to working in a particular way with homeless on the streets. So an authoritarian police officer would want to round them up and jail them and fine them and whatever, and that's not going to change anything for them. But if you take a relational approach to problem solving and you show that you care and you find out what the hell's happening, then you get a different outcome. So having worked with a particular school in Auckland over the last couple of days, you know, seeing people shift from, but I'm the teacher here and you're making me feel bad about my contribution to this problem, when actually this really should all be all about the student, because the student was rude to me. I said, look, this restorative piece is not just about the kid. And what we have to understand is that it's the problem that's the problem. So if we can step back from finding fault and laying blame and both understand, teacher and student, that this relationship has got to work for learning to happen, then if I poked and prodded that kid to the point where they turned round and swore at me, or even if it wasn't something I deliberately did, but they'd come from home and what's happening at home is terrible, but I poked and prodded anyway and I didn't know that, and then they turned round and, you know, were horrible to me, then I've got to take responsibility for the fact that I actually escalated that problem when I need not have. Yeah. So restorative practice is hard on the problem, and it asks us to step up, because we're the adult in the room. We've got the one. We've got the prefrontal cortex that's meant to be working when kids' prefrontal cortexes aren't very good at their job, you know. So someone in the room's got to be a grown-up, and I think kids feel a great deal more respect for us if we can say just once in a while, hey kiddo, I blew it.
Yeah. And
the way I dealt with you wasn't fair, and I understand that I publicly humiliate you, and actually that's not right, and I have to own that. So thank you for the feedback, and I'm really sorry that that was your experience of it, and I'm going to have to think about the way I do things in the future.
I think that's what led me to actually finding out the work that you were doing. When I was, you know, that person that people would send a student to when they were in trouble, with a capital T, and I just completely screwed it up. It was a complete train wreck. And I didn't slow down to check what I'd been led to believe was absolute proof of things. And it was just ridiculous. And I thought, this should never be where we end up. And so I talked with that student later on and said, look, I just got this really wrong, and I'm just letting you know what I'm doing to try and fix that, and worked hard to fix it with them, I really did, but also actually fed back to them, you realise that what we're doing across the whole school was because of how that had worked with you, and when I got that really wrong. So thank you for taking that really well, but hopefully it's actually going to change the whole school, and it certainly changed who I was.
Well, there's a couple of things in that story, Pete, that, you know, make my brain dart all over the place. And first of all, it's the issue of outsourcing, and that is, you know, teacher's fed up with the kid and sends the child off for someone else to deal with. Now, The issue with that is that if I hand the problem over to you, you will make a decision about how it will be dealt with, and I have lost all control. Second bit about that is that the kid doesn't respect me anymore for sending him to you, because they see me as not being able to manage. And thirdly is the issue of who owns the relationship. And the teacher might well have reached the end of their tether, and that does happen, and it's far better that the child is sent away to somewhere safe than have your hands around their throat, metaphorically. But when we think about referring a child onwards, we should never just hand them over. We should stay with the problem. So I would then come to you and say, Pete, little Jack is driving me crazy. Can you set up a meeting with Mum and Dad and Jack and me, and can you be Switzerland and be neutral yeah. and help us with yeah. this problem, rather than Jack's yours and I divest myself of any responsibility? Mm. It's very important that we don't lose control, I don't think.
And that we know when we're close to that and actually take responsibility for it and really make that happen. But then recognise that there's a time limit on that, and at some point you're going to need to go back and be the adult that needs to manage that conversation. Does any of this stuff work with adults as well as students?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question for me, because part of how I earn my living is to be hired to be the Switzerland person to come in and help a faculty or a team or sometimes an entire school that has become dysfunctional and toxic, you know, to try and bring them back to a place of good health. And, you know, well-being and good health has never, ever been achieved by punishment. So while I would never discourage someone from making a formal complaint or putting in a personal grievance, please don't imagine that that process has as a possibility healing, because it doesn't. So I actually think that we need to be better at regulating our relationships with each other, so that everyone's clear about what's okay to do and what isn't okay to do. So I think, you know, we started out this restorative journey started in criminal justice. Well, modern restorative justice had its beginnings in the mid-70s, I suppose, and then it sort of morphed into youth justice, and then it made the leap across the boundary from youth justice into education. But schools that were experimenting maybe in the 2000s were saying, it's all very well to have this restorative stuff with kids, but actually we've got really bad pockets of dysfunction and sour relationships in some of our faculties and teams, and so what are you going to do about that, boss? Right? Or when you've got a senior leadership team in a school that itself is dysfunctional and it's really obvious to everyone, or where you've got inadequate performance management so that people aren't being held accountable in a useful and meaningful and effective way, how can we make the demands for high standards and high expectations but really understand that people might need to be supported to get over the line, and then if they're not, how do we hold them accountable? So, of course, the answer is restoratively, which means that whatever I do or I don't do in a workplace is going to have an impact on someone else. So, for example, if it's about getting my reports done on time and I fail to do that, then the next person downstream is held up. So, you know, people need to talk with each other before the reports get written, so that they can actually understand ahead of time what it's going to be like if things go wrong.
Do you take on every case that's available to you?
No, I don't.
Do you pick and choose? Maybe not the right phrase to say,
yes,
but
do you
decide if you're going to be useful?
I have to, first, well, there are a lot of questions in the early stages of someone coming to me. Right. So if we're talking about a school. So, for example, one of the cases I had to deal with early this year was a co-ed school in Queensland, and I happened to have the days available where I wasn't on a plane travelling over to New Zealand. And they said, we've got this problem that has escalated and we need your help. So, of course, I would go in and ask the people who phoned me, usually senior management, someone like that. So tell me what the problem is. Tell me who are the people in the problem.
Yes. Right?
So I need to know, I need to scope it first. What kind of outcome are you looking for here? What's your budget like? Because some problems can get fixed easily and other problems take months and months and months. So you need to be in for the long haul if you want, a sustainable outcome.
So the worst case scenario is I've got a bunch of teachers that need fixing and I'm sick of it and yeah. I just want you to come in for a Friday. We'll book it as a teachers only day.
And sort them out.
I want this hit on the head.
Yes, sorry, can't do that. Can't do it and won't do it.
Yeah.
But let me just paint the picture. Let me go and interview these people first, right, to find out what their issues are and where the sore spots are and what's happening, what they like about their workplace, what they hate about their workplace, and are there specific incidents over time that have happened that have continued to escalate or sour or just increase the problem. So, you know, probably the best case scenarios are where the senior leadership team completely understand the restorative philosophy, understand that there is no quick fix and, you know, are certain about what's possible and what isn't possible and what the risks are. Now, I can talk about a case that wasn't related to a school, but the level of distrust between the team and the two managers, the manager and his 2IC, was so extreme that I could not convince the people in the team into a restorative dialogue as the first instance. They simply did not trust. They were worried about retribution, and it was in the kind of public sector organisation that's highly authoritarian. So I said to HR, who'd asked me to help, I said, you know, I would give my right arm if I could just spend the day with the team and get them to talk to each other, not really to me because I know what their stories are, to talk to each other about what it's like for them to be in this team, to reach some sort of shared understanding about what they're up against and what they would like their workplace to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, HR said, Marg, why don't you do it? And I thought, I've nearly died and gone to heaven, you know. But that was only one small step in a much longer, broader, maybe a year-long process. And in fact, things may never have improved properly until the senior people in the team actually retired and there was new leadership.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, we think kids are difficult to deal with, but heavens above, adults are just kind of times 10 or to the 10th degree, you know.
Adults can put kids to shame when it comes to entrenched behaviours.
Absolutely. And you know, all that lovely work that's been done about, you know, Carol Dweck with growth mindsets, where we're trying to convince kids that they can change their neural pathways, I think we have to be prepared to rethink. And part of my job with training is to shift people to a point where they're even willing to experiment with a kind of a different approach. And some people are courageous with that, and even if their first attempt at a restorative session, problem solving doesn't work, they can just shake their heads and say, oh, that was interesting, now what can I do to improve it? Whereas other people would have their first go and say, no, that didn't work, so it's all a load of rubbish. So it's really about how courageous we ask people to be to change their way of doing things and how supportive we're prepared to be. because this is a big mindset and it's a big skill set that we're asking people to take up.
I'm glad you're leading that charge. Hey, thanks for coming today. It's fantastic.
It's been my pleasure, Pete. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us for the Point of Learning podcast. Point of Learning is brought to you by N4L, the people connecting schools to the managed network and empowering teachers through POND. If you want to learn more and find useful links in the show notes, go to pond.co.nz and search for Point of Learning. If you or someone you know is doing some great work that needs sharing, get in touch at pointoflearning@n4l.co.nz. Great teaching is happening everywhere. Let's bring it here. Till next time, ka kite anō.